If you missed the Wizards GM, Will Dawkins, on with us earlier on the show, we'll play it back for you later on this hour. He was really good talking about the three players they added in the draft, Trey Johnson at six, and Ben Standing, I know, is excited about the Wizards draft. He misses the Wizards beat. Not really. We'll talk football team here in a moment, but I'm curious, what did you think about what the Wizards did with Trey Johnson, with Will Riley, and with Jameer Watkins, the three picks? Do you have a strong opinion on what they did?
Not in terms of like the players. Like, it's just, you know, these guys, all the one and done stuff, it's just, you know, so hard to figure out. Trey Johnson was obviously an excellent shooter, but conceptually, yeah, I continue to like what they're doing. You know, you're taking as many, the whole, you know, they don't label it. It's not called the process, right? But the point of the process is to get as many dart throws as you can to find talent. And that's what they're doing right now. And, you know, I don't have any issue with that. I mean, the kid they took in the second round last night, Watkins, he's 24 years old. That is young in real term. He's everybody, all their other young guys are like 20 and younger. Like, he's the old man of the group at 24. So they are, you know, it's a long process, but I'm good with it. I do think, you know, we all lamented about the fact that they didn't at the lottery get, you know, the first or second pick. I mean, now it turns out even getting the sixth pick was one spot too far if you wanted Ace Bailey, seeing as how he would have been there at five, presumably. But it is what it is. Trey Johnson's a pretty good consolation prize, and yeah, they just keep adding pieces.
Yeah, I mean, for me, it wasn't the consolation prize. I was more on Trey Johnson than I was Ace Bailey, but, you know, this is a matter of opinion, and nobody really knows about any of these guys.
Yeah.
I did ask yesterday on the show, Chase, about the, you know, reports that the Wizards were interested in trading up. He thought that those reports were true, and he thought that more likely than not, it was, you know, maybe for Harper or VJ Edgecombe to get up, you know, into that area of the draft. Dylan Harper, I would have loved to have seen here. I like the kid from Baylor too, but they have been aggressive, you know, trading up. It's like five drafts. I was talking about this yesterday. Tell me if you agree. The Koulibaly draft, the three first rounders last year, the two picks in the second rounder this year. They've got a lot more picks next year in what is thought to be a loaded draft once again, especially at the top of it. And then maybe one more draft after that, but definitely four drafts. You'll end up with, you know, somewhere in the neighborhood of 10, you know, young players, and you hope that you have a real star and a really good two and three so that you can then start to look to contend or compete and win, probably starting in 2027 at the earliest. What do you say?
Yeah, I remember last year, the like a minute after they traded Denny Avdija to the Blazers in a deal that ultimately led them to get Bob Carrington, I tweeted, this is confirming to me that the Wizards are not really going to be in contention until like 2029 or 2028, maybe, if one of these rookies gets going. Because the reason you make that Denny Avdija trade, who's obviously a good player, is his timeline is not matching where they are. He's, you know, an older guy because he's been in the league. So they're trying to get everybody in the same timeline, which is now all these, you know, 20-year-olds. By definition, almost, the 20-year-olds are going to have to wait. You know, it's going to take a couple years for them to get going unless they get somehow land a guy who turns out to be a stud. You know, the Thunder were the youngest team in the league this year, but, you know, at least SGA has been in the league for a minute. All the other guys are fairly young, but SGA, excuse me, has been around a little bit. So, you know, the Wizards need, I mean, they need a lot still, but yeah, I agree. This is, I mean, this year they have to finish bottom eight in order to keep their first round pick. And then after that, you know, these guys will still only be like 20 and 21 and such. So yeah, they've got a little ways to go here. But everything is pointing in the right direction. And, you know, I'm not paying for tickets, so I totally get it. If that's, you know, people are frustrated because they want to see wins, but, you know, hopefully you can get excited about, you know, watching. It's like, you know, watching expensive, you know, AAA. to a degree. But you know, hopefully they get you know, some of these guys continue to improve and show they can be, you know, high rotation pieces.
You know, you mentioned somebody, and I was a big fan of his upside. They traded Denny Avdija. Denny Avdija, by the way, is just 24 years old, believe it or not. He had an unbelievable finish. Once he got completely healthy and was playing 30-some minutes a game, he averaged 26 and 12, basically, over the last month and a half of the season in Portland. I actually have always felt about him and did feel about him watching him that he had, you know, a number three contributor sort of, you know, position on a contending team, a guy that would be on the periphery, if not, you know, make an all-star game. I know people told me I was crazy, and maybe I'm still crazy, but he's only 24, he's 6'9", he can handle it, his shooting has gotten better, and he just knows how to play. And I looked this up because I was following him during the regular season just to see what kind of season, and he just ended with a flourish. And once he started averaging 35 minutes a game instead of 25, he averaged 26 and 12, you know, not in like six assists. I mean, he was really good. Portland wasn't, but I think he's still got a chance to be a really, really good player. Before we get to any sort of football team conversation, stadium, RFK deal has been in the news. What is your thought on everything that's happened this week with, you know, Mendelsohn pulling it from the budget or threatening to pull it for the budget, and the vote on the stadium agreement that the city has, that the mayor cut with the team, may get delayed to August, may get delayed beyond that. The team isn't very happy about it. Where do you come down on all of this, on how it will play out?
Yeah, I mean, my general assumption, and then maybe this is my cynicism, is that this sounded to be like politics. Like, you know, look, we already knew that some people on the council, including Mendelsohn, didn't exactly love parts of this. But he even said, you know, right after that press conference with Josh Harris and Mayor Bowser a few weeks back, that, yeah, it's going to get done, but we got to go through the steps. So to me, it just feels like, on the surface, that they're saying, hey, look, Josh Harris, we want to get this done, but if you want this done on the timeline that you want, we need to renegotiate here a little bit. You know, what they want to renegotiate, I don't know. I know there was a point that was made a few weeks back that, like, you know, I think the deal has the Commanders paying like a dollar, or rent like a dollar a year or something.
Yeah.
Whereas like the Nats, I think, are paying like $6 million or something. So I don't know what it would be, but, you know, the second they made, the Commander said they were going to, you know, wanted to do this, you know, it felt to me like the leverage shifted to DC. Again, not saying, you know, hopefully they're working together and they can find a good deal that makes sense for both. Now, if they really need to study this more, whatever that means, you know, literally read the documents or have, you know, hire somebody to, well, you know, I'm just like, whatever it is, that hire a group to, you know, do some more studying on this, you know, because it has only been a few weeks. Maybe there's something to that, but, you know, the Commanders have been pretty, you know, insistent that, hey, we need to get this done by, you know, that July 15th deadline for the DC budget, because, you know, 2030, if you want that to happen, that's, you know, it takes a while to get the ball rolling. They would get shovel in the dirt sometime next year and go from there. And, you know, we talk about it from the perspective of the Commanders, but they're also looking at it, all these other events they're trying to bring to the city, like the Women's World Cup in 2031. And, you know, it's hard. You're not going to be able to get groups to commit to showing up if you can't commit to you're going to have a stadium. So I think that's the rub. Again, I would imagine something gets done, but
the Women's,
you know,
World Cup. Well, I'll interrupt. Tommy just went nuts yesterday with me on the podcast. He's like, really? The Women's World Cup in 2031? That's what you're using as, you know, trying to create urgency? But the truth is, it is a big event, and it would be great for the city as much as it would be great for the team and everything that they would have invested in hosting that.
Yeah, no, I mean, look, you know, Taylor Swift has not announced her 2030-2031 concert tour. You know, like, those things don't exist. A lot of the other events, like, say, the Final Four, you know, that's probably, they've already probably booked that, you know, beyond 2030 already. So, yeah, I mean, this is the next thing, and it's just, you know, an example of, hey, we want to start to do this. I mean, look, obviously, if they somehow didn't get that done, you know, I don't think it's, you know, the whole thing's not going to fall apart. But, you know, the larger point is they want to get this done. And, you know, in order to get this done by 2030, which is also, of course, for the football side of things, I mean, that's, you know, ultimately what the, you know, the primary goal is. Let's go. Well, you know, we you know, everybody's been waiting. Let's get this done. So we'll see. I can't even imagine what it would take for the deal to collapse to a degree that Harris would even consider going back to Maryland or staying in Maryland. So it's not that, I don't think. It's just, hey, you know, what are we doing here? But again, you know, DC has the right to, you know, shape the deal, and we'll see what they do.
Talking to Ben Standing at Ben Standing, that is, on X, on Twitter. Ben Standing writes for The Athletic, and he's got a really good podcast called Last Man Standing. So I just did a segment where, you know, no NFC East repeat winners, we all know, since 2004. So if the Eagles don't become the first since 2004 to repeat, who wins the division? Obviously, in this market, everybody's going to say Washington. Jordan Renan, who writes for the for ESPN.com, covers the Giants, actually picked the Cowboys. And if you look at the rosters, they're comparable. You know, the Dallas healthy, even the Giants roster is pretty impressive. But I won't ask you the same question. I'll just ask you this. Who's going to win the NFC East in 2025?
I mean, you know, it's hard to not say the Eagles, except for the fact that, as you just laid out, that repeat winners don't happen here. You know, it's certainly plausible that they have a bit of that, you know, Super Bowl champion hangover. Their team, you know, I think it's fair to say they got a little bit worse in the offseason just because they lost some guys, especially on the defensive line. They still are very talented, but I don't know. I mean, obviously Washington has, you know, Jaden Daniels, and they, you know, the momentum from last year. We all have questions about the defense, and we'll see. Dallas has a lot of, like, obviously high end talent. So, you know, they did make some additions this offseason that felt like they were sort of finally addressing some of their bigger needs that they didn't deal with last year. So, yeah, it wouldn't stun me if Dallas shot up. And I do think the Giants, like, their defense should be pretty good. That defensive line is going to be impressive.
Yeah.
And, you know, whatever Russell Wilson is, he's, you know, better than what they've had in recent years. So, look, I think all these teams to some degree could feel optimistic, but, you know, I'd have to go Philly. It's a lame analysis just to say, well, they just, you know, look what they did last year, but that kind of is my default until proven otherwise. It's hard for me to say the hangover until, you know, I get it, but we get to see them actually do some things. But, you know, I would say Philly, but I, you know, history says I'm way wrong by making that call.
Any feel for Terry McLaurin? Any update? Any, you know, anything you've learned, or are we just all waiting for right before camp?
I don't know if it's right before camp, but yeah, I think it's still, in my senses, that it's still quiet at the moment. You know, I'm sure there's a contact going on to some degree, but I haven't heard anything that would, you know, tell me that it's, you know, we're going to have to talk about this on Monday or anything like that. So, you know, my stance has been, you know, wake me up when we get to training camp and, you know, players are reporting and he hasn't signed a deal. Then I start to get a little more concerned. But for now, I'm just, you know, similar to what we just talked about with the DC stadium stuff, like, this is part of the process. Everybody's got to, you know, do what they need to do to get the best deal. But, you know, I'd be stunned if they can't figure out how to some sort of common ground. We've talked about before, you know, unless Washington is putting a real emphasis on, you know, the age thing, but with him turning 30 this year, which, you know, for that position, you know, I understand the drop-off can start somewhere around there, but he's shown no signs of that at all. So hopefully, I would think that can't be too big of a deal. But other than that, I would just imagine they eventually do get something done, you know, somewhere in that $30 million range. Maybe it's a little bit less, but that would be the range I keep looking at.
Yeah, me too. Right around 30 makes sense. And, you know, there's going to be a significant cash outlay for the team, the biggest one they've made for a player since they took over as owners of this team. But I was thinking that, you know, what if you got into some sort of protracted, you know, holdout? I don't see that happening. I think worst case is Terry just plays 2025 on the final year of his deal, and then the team can, you know, choose to franchise tag him next year or get him signed. I hope it doesn't come to that, because it never feels great. Especially in this situation, it wouldn't feel great if they didn't get a deal done. You know, it happens. Players go into their final year, play on their final year deal. But you agree, right, that if it did happen and he played just on the final year of his deal, that it would be kind of... It just wouldn't feel right. There are players that have done it in recent years after contract negotiations that haven't gone well, but this one just wouldn't feel right because of, I think, how much respect and how well-liked he is.
No, 100%. You know, if they're going to say they have a standard for the type of player they want, or not just a player, but the type of person they want, you know, I don't know how you'll look at Terry McLaurin and say, Here's the prime example. This guy, you know, he puts in the work. He speaks up when he needs to in the locker room. He helps players out. He's great in the community, and he's a hell of a player. And our quarterback, he's the go-to weapon for Jaden Daniels. So it would be, it would feel very odd if they didn't get things done. He could play it out, but you know, even with that, you know, they have, this is the problem why agents hate the franchise tag, because the Commanders can always be like, cool, we'll play it out, and if we want to, we'll just tag you next year. And, you know, there's nothing he can do. So, yeah, when you start to get to that situation, it becomes, you know, unsettling. You know, the player starts to lose some trust in the organization, and that's the absolute last thing you want here, because, again, what he represents in that locker room, for that guy to question what's going on in the building would be problematic. And, you know, I think that has to be factored into what they do, which is why I ultimately think it gets done. But yeah, no, if it does go along, a long way into camp, but you know, that would be not good.
Let's assume Terry's in the fold and he's ready to play 2025 and everybody's happy. Who's the second leading pass reception guy on the team next year?
Good question. Well, I guess I'll say Deebo Samuel, but, you know, he's not going to be like a volume pass catcher. You know, he is not a traditional receiver. He's more of a gadget guy, plays in the slot, can play outside. But, like, you just find different ways to get him the ball. That's why he gets touches. But the other reason I would pick him is, you know, look, Noah Brown's history of his career is he does not stay healthy. And not that Deebo is a guy that's, you know, he's not Cal Ripken Jr., but, you know, plays a bit more. So if Noah Brown doesn't play the full season, misses, you know, X amount of games, you know, I don't see another wide receiver catching enough passes. I guess I could reframe that and say maybe it's Zach Ertz is number two. I forgot about him. Maybe Zach Ertz again. I hopefully he can stay healthy. So yeah, I guess if we're talking number of catches, yeah, I'll change my mind to Ertz, because he's, you know, even if they're, you know, underneath, you know, he obviously proved to be a really reliable target for Jaden last year, and he is more of a volume pass catcher based on what they did last year. So yeah, okay, I'm revising. I'll go with Ertz.
In San Francisco, he, I think, has only led the team in receptions once back in 21. It's been Ayuk and Kittle and McCaffrey who have consistently been ahead of him, or at least two of the three were ahead of him in San Francisco. But obviously, yardage and overall yardage, including some of his rushing yardage, has been a big deal. All right. Thanks for doing this. Have a good weekend. I'll talk to you on Monday.
Always, man. See ya.
Ben Standing, everybody. The all too early NBA mock drafts are out. This isn't something that you're probably waiting on in terms of the players that will be picked, but who gets projected more than anybody else to pick number one in next year's NBA draft? I'll give you the answer when we come back. Kevin Sheehan Show, the Team 980 and theteam980.com. So when the NBA draft ends, just like with the NFL draft, you get the all-too-early 2026 mock drafts. ESPN's is out picking number one on the clock. Washington Wizards. Now, of course, that, you know, is the odds that they are factoring in that they finish as one of the worst teams in the league, the third, you know, one of the three worst teams in the league, and they win the lottery next year. They've got the Utah Jazz and the Brooklyn Nets. Now, is the Brooklyn Nets picking? I think they've got a protected pick. And then same thing with CBSSports.com. The Wizards are projected to have the number one pick, and they both have the same player. So next year's NBA draft is loaded at the top of the draft. Darren Peterson is the number one player in America. He's going to Kansas. He's a 6'6" point guard. You will, you know, hear a lot about him, watch a lot of him at Kansas next year. Everybody believes he will be the best player, or certainly one of the best players in college basketball next year. He was the best player in high school this year, a scoring point guard, a high flyer, the whole thing. Darren Peterson, one of those people. Both CBS Sports and ESPN.com project Washington to take Darren Peterson number one overall next year. Cameron Boozer, one of the twin sons of Carlos Boozer, has been sort of a projected number one, number two, number three pick in the 2026 draft forever. He's going to Duke, and he'll play next year at Duke, where his father played. 6'9", one of the, you know, best high school careers and one of the best high school players people have ever seen. Played for that Columbus in Miami. They've been a powerhouse with him. So he's going to be in the mix. AJ Dibanza, who is a 6'9" guy playing last year in the state of Utah, is going to BYU. He's thought to be in the mix for number one overall as well. Then there are guys like Nate Ament. He's going to Tennessee. And a few others. There's this kid that's going to Kentucky that's kind of a center, 6'10", 6'11". So, yeah, next year's draft, super loaded at the top. So if they didn't get their, you know, superstar top five player in this draft, next year will be another opportunity, because more likely than not, with the age of the team that they will put out on the floor next year, they're going to win 20-something games and be in that bottom three, more likely than not. So stay tuned for that. But next year's draft should be exciting. But it's always interesting to see. I mean, not that I thought the Wizards would be, you know, projected to take the number seven pick or outside the lottery. Let's just hope they get a little better luck in the lottery next year. But even that doesn't guarantee you anything. But Darren Peterson, I've watched some of the highlights of this kid in high school. Kansas has a chance to be really good. Boy, they were disappointing. You know who did not get selected in the draft? And remember, you know, after his first year at Michigan, Hunter Dickinson was thought to be, you know, a star, the whole thing. I think New Orleans added him on an undrafted free agent two-way deal. But Hunter Dickinson did not get drafted. But look, I'm not feeling sorry for him. He made a lot of money in college, you know, with Kansas the last couple of years. There was always an issue with Hunter Dickinson, who went to DeMatha, you know, famously, you know, ripped Mark Turgeon for not recruiting him. You know, it turns out he was a bit of a head case, you know, in his college career, very long college career. You know, went after Turge in Maryland when they came, when they played him that year three times, including in the Big Ten tournament. Some great games with Michigan that year. But he just had, he had that issue that you can't have if you're a big man. You can't be short-armed. It just doesn't work no matter what your height is. If you've got short arms, you are going to be downgraded significantly. You know, Tyler Hansbrough was one of the greatest college players in the history of the ACC, in the history of college basketball. He had a decent NBA career playing in Indiana primarily, right? Tyler Hansbrough mostly played for the Pacers. I'm looking it up. But he always had an issue, and it's the reason I think he stayed and played four college years, is at 6'9", 6'10", relentless competitor, you know, but he had super short arms, and it always limited him. Played for the Pacers for 5 years and the Raptors for three and then the Hornets for two. He had an eight-year NBA career and then played overseas a bunch. Looks like in China. All right, when we come back, if you missed it in the very beginning of the show, Wizards GM Will Dawkins jumped on with us. We'll play that back for you next. Kevin Sheehan Show, the Team 980, and the Team980.com.
All right, the NBA draft has reached its conclusion. The Wizards take Jameer Watkins with the 43rd overall selection that they received in the trade with the Utah Jazz. Watkins is a two-way guard from Florida State who spent his first two seasons at Virginia Commonwealth and has made a name for himself through his elite defensive prowess and NBA-ready frame. The Washington Capitals made a trade last night, sending a 2026 second-round pick and a 2027 sixth-round pick to Florida for forward Justin Sordeef. The Nats are underway in Anaheim tonight. The Jake Irvin will take the hill against Jose Soriano to kick off the final series of a West Coast road trip for the Nats. The first pitch is at 9:35. Nats on deck with Charlie and Dave at 9:05. This update is sponsored by the Team 980 YouTube page. Just open the app, type in the Team 980, hit subscribe. Kevin Sheehan is live from 10 to 1 and Craig Hoffman from 4 to 7. Don't forget to like the stream and turn on notifications to stay up to date on all things DC sports. And that is what's trending.
By the way, if you're interested, I am. The Wizards right now have two first-round picks next year and six second-round picks. I'm sorry, two first-round picks and eight second-round picks next year, as of now. That could change. There are swap rights, there are protections, all those different things. But they are loaded up in the draft next year and in 2027, 2028. And 2029 as well. Pretty set for 2030, if you're interested. So earlier on the show, the general manager of the Washington Wizards, Will Dawkins, gave us some time. I started off by asking him sort of about how this draft went. You know, they prepare forever. Some drafts go exactly as they sort of plan them out. Others tend to throw curveballs. How would he describe this draft from the last two nights?
Yeah, first off, thanks for having me. Happy to be on this morning. I would say very rarely do they go as you plan. I think a lot of times you just put in the work and preparation and try to build through every contingency you can think through. And we try to do that for as long as possible. But I'd say last 2 days were fun for our group. We got better and we're able to get guys that we were targeting. So we felt good about the outcome for sure.
So rarely it goes the way it's supposed to. In the first round, you're sitting there at six. Did it go the way you thought it would go, and did you get the guy you wanted?
Yeah, Trey's someone that we were excited about, who was in our top five all year. I won't tell you where he was, but he was up there. And when you get that guy, when you fall out of the top five on lottery night, you still feel pretty good about that. So our scouts were on him early, and we went to see him practice, play a lot early, and he just was able to continue that run in SEC play. The scoring prowess that he had was really impressive for a freshman.
So what did you love most about him?
Once we got to know him during the visit, I really fell in love with his passion for the game, his IQ, and his ability to see the game and be ahead of plays. We threw him in a couple film sessions, put him in the workout, and threw him in Wizards play calls, and he picked up on stuff really quickly. But at the end of the day, he's a pure hooper. He's someone that has a repeatable shot. It's rare when you find someone who can shoot the ball with the same efficiency off the dribble as he does off the catch at such a high clip. So he's someone that's going to score. He's got to get better scoring at the rim, but he can score from deep. He can score from the mid-range, and he's got a passing creativity that will be, I think, exposed a little bit and enlightened a little bit more when he's with us.
Is it true, in your opinion, that once a shooter, always a shooter? Like somebody who's a shooter at 10 can still shoot it at 60?
Yeah, I think shooting is a swing skill that's hard to develop at times. You really have to work on it. But when you master it early and you have that size to where he has the wingspan to still get it off over people, that's not going to change.
Yeah, I'm actually interested in the specific things you look for in a shooter, other than he just makes a lot of them. Tell me about like what you look for in a stroke, in a setup, in, you know, how that kind of matches Trey's shooting ability.
Yeah, I think shooting is one of those skills where repetition is probably the most important thing. I think I've grown as an evaluator in terms of actual release of shots and technique, but there are some things that remain pure. And when you watch him versus some of the elite shooters, the fact that the ball gets the type of rotation it does, comes off his final two fingers very easily. He has the rotation, but it's also a repeatable shot, whether he shoots it quickly or has a full time to gather. And he has the range where his body mechanics are exactly the same no matter where he is. And to me, someone that has that type of balance to shoot it off 1 foot, 2 feet, wherever he catches it from, like that's a difficult shot to contest. And for us, I think it's a repeatable shot for him, which makes him the type of high arcing player that he is.
Yeah, you really see that backward rotation off those fingers. But I'm wondering about the release. Do you think it's quick enough?
I do. And I think he was someone in the SEC that had two players draped on him the entire last part of the season. Yeah. And he wasn't getting a lot of open shots. So for him to be able to create off the dribble and get those shots, which are a little bit more tough and contested, playing with the guys that we have now, we hopefully we'll get some easier ones and he won't need to shoot it as quick. But we put him in drills where you had to catch it, not be able to bring it down and try to keep that same elbow and release. And he's able to do it now without spending a lot of time on it.
I heard your answer the other night to Trey admitting and appreciating, by the way, that you guys showed him, you know, some of the moments that weren't so flattering for him. And even though you said you weren't thrilled, I thought maybe some of it was tongue-in-cheek. Maybe it wasn't. But I loved your answer when you said that you do it because you want to see how he handles answering it. So what are you looking for in how a player handles seeing some of their rough moments?
Yeah, I think it's a big thing to just see how they communicate. They're going to be put in situations where they're going to have to talk and speak in front of the coaches and their players. I think it shows a sign of humility for a player to admit kind of what's going on, but it also gives us a lot of answers to the test. The reasons why you go to practice and you go to shoot around is to try to understand game plans and schemes and what's really being asked of them. And when players can repeat back and remember the situations and know what the coverages were, it shows you that they're at least watching and trying to get better. So we're looking for people that want to improve, won't run, and be authentic. And we're going to hit you between the eyes while you're here. We want to make sure you can handle that. And I think it's always good for us to get on the front end of that and know the type of person we're coming in, and they know the environment they're walking into. And we're always going to try to get 1% better every single day. And I think while he was here, he did that. And I think that's why he mentioned it, because when you come in, we don't just want to roll the balls out. We want to see where you're at, and hopefully you learn something.
Yeah, you know, over the years, I've talked to so many GMs and coaches who, you know, have said they do the same thing with young players that come in for the interviews, and they're looking to see, you know, when they throw an interception, you know, what happened on this play. And what they're looking for is accountability, but most importantly, did he learn from it? Or is he throwing people under the bus and making excuses? That's a big reveal on character. True?
Very true. The accountability piece, you do get in those film sessions, and it was the coach this, it was my teammate was supposed to be here, so you have to ask those type of questions. But we also try to do a good job of cutting it up so that we're showing the same exact situation and then making the right read as well. So like, okay, tell me the difference between this and this. What part of the season was this? When did you grow and figure this read out? Like that way we can go behind the process of it. But you're absolutely right. There are some excuse makers out there, and you don't want too many of them in your building, so that's also a tell for us.
One of the things that I noticed in watching Trey in some of those, you know, incredible SEC games this year is just how fearless he was. Like, first game in Vegas against Ohio State, he put up 20 shots. He had 10 three-point attempts and ended up with 29. You've mentioned, you know, the competitive high motors of Riley and of Trey Johnson, and I think the guy you drafted last night as well. with scores and shooters in particular, when a guy walks out onto the court and thinks he's open, the first time he touches the ball wherever he is there a balance of that being really good and also not being great?
Yeah, I think those guys that we drafted with Will Riley and Jameer, they're all at different phases of their career where they're finding themselves still. But they are confident. And when you talk about Trey and some of his performances out the gate, we'd rather have to turn you down than turn you up. And that's kind of what we look for in our players. So we want them to be aggressive, be confident, and go get it from the tip. And we think we added three guys that are going to do that.
Coach Thompson, John Thompson, Jr., as in the legendary Coach Thompson, worked for this station for many years, and he always said, I'd rather have to tame, an animal than resurrect a corpse. And I think that's exactly what you're saying. Yeah.
Yeah, he said it a little bit more eloquently than me.
No, you said it well, too. So tell us about what you guys liked in Will Riley.
Yeah, so Will's someone who has traditional size for his position. He's someone who, when you watched him prior to coming to Illinois, was someone who had the ball in his hands, could create plays, make shots, and actually get to the rim. And I think we saw that once they had some injuries at Illinois, the second part of the year, they started to put the ball in his hands and give him an opportunity to just create. And he was fearless on the offensive end, went toe-to-toe in another really physical conference. And he's someone who, when we checked in on his body, we expect him to even grow some more. So for him to be able to be 70th percentile in assist and 85th percentile in assist to turnover ratio, it means he protects the ball and looks for others while being able to score. And that's what we're looking for, guys that can just rebound it and bring the ball up. When you have Alex and Keyshawn and Bub, Bilal, and all the guys we have, we just want to play offensive basketball where you don't know who's starting it and everybody can be a threat.
You know, Will, in watching Oklahoma City over the last 2 months, and you were a big part of, the architect of that team, and watching the players that you look for now, man, high motor, intense, highly competitive personalities are a priority for you guys, aren't they?
Yeah, there's a lot of characteristics we look for in the 94x50. We're pretty specific on what we look for on the court. But we also have an environmental bucket that we look for, and we send our scouts out there to get as much intel and information as we can to make sure that when we bring these guys into the building, we won't push guys, meaning that we want guys that come in that have similar attributes and are going to just only push the group forward. You don't want too many pull guys that need to be pulled around and eventually try to catch up. So right now we're in the mode of giving everyone that comes in is going to have that competitive fiber and that juice and that work ethic and be serious craftsmen, because that's the environment we're trying to build, so that they push everybody in the gym. So having multiple players that want to compete and get after it, but will do so the right way and be good teammates, those guys are going to do well here in D.C.
You know, Brad Underwood said about Will Riley when you guys picked him the other night, his coach at Illinois said he's the second best offensive player he's ever coached, next to Michael Beasley when he was an assistant with Frank Martin way back in the day. He's got that kind of potential offensively?
I did not see that comment. I got to know him well when he was at Oklahoma State and I was at Oklahoma. And I remember those Beasley days at Kansas State. Those were some fun practices to go watch as a young evaluator.
I bet.
But I would say if he were to go back in the Big Ten, we expected him to have a massive jump, and you wouldn't be getting a player as offensively gifted as him in the 20s. Plus, we were able to move back and still get him and pick up three assets in the second round. So Mike Winger, Mike Hartman, those guys that are helping with our strategy piece. It was a good combination of evaluation and a strategy coming together that first night of the draft. And we knew that we were getting a player who wouldn't be in that range if he would have went back to school. So we bet on that type of development.
All right. Tell me what you got last night in the Florida State kid. Is he Lou Dort?
He is physical. He is long. He is tough. He is defensive-minded. And that's what we really liked about him. But he also is someone that moved the scoreboard and got better offensively. But each meeting with these kids are different, Got to spend a lot of time at dinner with Trey. Actually got a one-on-one breakfast with Will, like, before the workout. And then you get Jameer in your office, and he's just like, I'm all business. I'm here to hoop. Put me on whoever you want. I'm going to compete. And you just felt that vibe, and then he went out there and did it. And you're like, you are who we thought you were, and that's why we targeted him. but he just plays with a force and a physicality on both ends, and that's kind of a rare combination when you can be tops in the country in free throw attempts, but also 75th percentile in steals. So, like, you're hitting people on both ends, and that's what we need.
Is Dort a good comp or not? I mean, the build isn't the same, but is that a good comp?
Not too far off. I think when Lou went undrafted, he kind of had a little bit more of an offensive vibe to him and kind of transformed and realized that's how you get on the floor and has continued to improve offensively, defensively, and obviously a first-team all-defensive guy from the work he put in. So, again, this is the type of kid you bet on physically to be able to put him in those type of situations.
Do you guys do that? We do that.
Do like all the other guys. Say it again, I'm sorry?
Yeah, no, do you guys do that? We do that all the time. You know, who's his comp? You know, who's his NBA comp? Do you do that as you evaluate players?
Yeah, as long as we're not being lazy with it. As you can imagine in those scouting meetings, I don't want the lazy comps. I want us to think through them, try to find physical comps as well as basketball comps. And sometimes you have to blend the comparisons of the two and let those guys have an opportunity. But it's more of a range. Like, on a high end, he can have this type of impact on a team, and that's the most important thing that we look for.
So what's Trey Johnson's high end comp? Who?
I think he's someone who is going to make plays for others and be able to stay on the floor in the playoffs and impact it on both ends, and that's a high level player for us.
But do you have a name? Do you have a comp?
No, I think you can ask him because he kind of favors his game after a few people. But the guys that are making deep playoff runs that could play on the ball and are always a threat, he kind of fits in the mold of those guys.
We're talking to Will Dawkins, the Wizards general manager. Let me just make sure. Can you talk about the trade at this point from earlier this week or not?
Not officially. That has not gone through yet.
All right, then let's just talk about the roster as it stands now, and maybe there are changes coming. We haven't had free agency yet, but size on the roster next year. Do you have enough of it, or is more coming?
Yeah, I would say when you look at some of the transactions that haven't gone through yet, when you're having to make those challenging and difficult decisions during the rebuild phase, the main focus is always going to be to put the organization in a position for our long-term success. And for us, the decisions we made and will continue to make are less about position and more about getting the type of guys we want in here stylistically, and then also giving them the runway to develop, but providing us strategically the most flexibility to continue to add. So as we go through this process of free agency and finalizing the roster and making moves and trades potentially, I think we have a good assortment of young players that want to play and veteran players who are more than capable of playing and are actually very beneficial and helpful to have around because they're good players on the court as well. So we have a good blend of who we want in the locker room right now. We'll definitely make a few more tweaks, but I wouldn't say we're after one specific thing heading into free agency.
Well, I think you did, if everybody was paying attention, you kind of answered the question. I think one of the parts that I just want to nail down, because I think you implied it there, is this is the year where it's time to kind of turn the team over to these very young players that you've picked the last couple of years and give them higher usage rates, more shot attempts, more minutes, etc., right?
Yeah, I think Brian did a tremendous job. Brian Keefe, our head coach last year. Three of those rookies that we drafted were top five in minutes for their rookie class. So he gave them experience, and that's when they were able to produce at a high level. We have a lot of confidence in them, but also Bilal, Champagne, AJ, some of our other young players and the players we've drafted, Tristan, to kind of give those guys an opportunity as well. And at the end of the day, staying flexible and playing deep rotations, I think, is what proved was beneficial for a lot of these teams in the playoffs. So establishing that at an early age, I think, is good as well.
All right, last one, and I appreciate the time. So how excited were you, and how much pride did you take in watching your former team, Oklahoma City, win it all?
Super happy, overjoyed for them, everyone in the city, but everyone I work with and all the teammates that all the players that have come through in the Thunder organization. Definitely excited for all that. They have some great people over there. They deserved it. My family was super excited. My family that lived back in Oklahoma were at the games and at the parade. So happy for them. Hopefully they can keep it going down there. But we're kind of focused on building our own path here in D.C. But it was a cool moment for sure.
Congrats on the last few days. Thanks for doing this. Really appreciate it.
No, anytime. You guys have a good one.
That was from earlier with the general manager of the Wizards, Will Dawkins. So we are done with the NBA draft. Free agency comes up in the next week. Next week, July 4th, right? Yeah. Next week is July 4th, Friday of next week. And then you get free agency, I think, the following week in the NBA. That'll be interesting for sure. Don't expect the Wizards to be major big spenders. It is interesting. One thing that he said is that that trade from earlier this week isn't finalized until July 6th. And it is possible that there's another part to that trade with CJ McCollum or with Kelly Olynyk. We'll find out next week. That was a lot of NBA this week. I enjoyed it. I know some of you did. We'll be back to primarily football and a lot more next week. Have a great weekend. Stick around. Chris Russell's next.